This edition of The Cinema Show was first broadcast on the 9th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. The Cinema Show, in association with Mubi. A flock of first films up for discussion today as we take a closer look at the directorial debut of some of today's most acclaimed filmmakers. Coming up, considered today one of Europe's cinematic masters, how did Italy's Antonioni become an auteur?
He's really good at character, and he's really good at finding ways of showing those characters' internal states. And I think he's mesmerized by the kind of sexual attraction that a femme fatale can have.
We'll also look at the feature debut by Todd Haynes, director of 2015's standout achievement, Carol. Plus, why did Stanley Kubrick disown his first film? And we'll consider how some of history's most influential filmmakers predicted their own success in their earliest features. That's all to come today on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of film on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House in London today, and I'm joined by one of my favourite film lovers. She was once charged with the very delicate responsibility of curating the incredible mix of trash and treasure projected upon the fine screen of the Astor Theatre in Melbourne, Australia. Today, she's based right here in the UK, dividing her time between a film rental shop in Bristol and various other festival endeavours. Tara Judah, welcome to The Cinema Show. Now, the world seems to be fairly unanimous that the old concept of renting a movie as a hard copy is done and dusted. Clearly, you're not on board with that.
No, I think people still watch movies in a variety of ways and across a number of platforms. There is still something to be said for the physical, tangible medium, largely to do with what's available, seeking out some of those titles that aren't available maybe online, or they're not being shown again in cinemas. And for real cinephiles, I think a kind of completist look at cinema means you really need to have a number of platforms available to you, and that includes home rental.
Now, of course, The Cinema Show is presented in association with Mubi, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning films. And to usher in the new year, they're screening a special season of first films by renowned directors, including Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies and Videotape and Mike Leigh's Bleak Moments, both screening here in the UK. And for US subscribers, there's Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, As Tears Go by Wong Kar-wai, and the debut film by Todd Haynes, Poison, which we'll discuss a little later. Tara, the first film is an interesting thing, though, isn't it? Because, of course, no director has any clue whether they'll have the opportunity to make another one.
Absolutely. When you start off your career, and I think this is true for a lot of these filmmakers, is one, they're experimenting. This is a kind of arena for them to try out those ideas that they've had. It's a gamble because, obviously, they really want to get it right, because if they get it right, it means that there'll be investors, there'll be studio deals, there'll be opportunities to continue a film career, but they never know when they set out those first few steps. And I think that's why we have issues with some filmmakers disowning or suppressing their earliest films or not being particularly proud, because they see some of the mistakes that they were making along the way before they perfected their art form.
But the flip side of that also is that first films can sometimes perhaps be a little bit bloated. I mean, not knowing that you're going to make another film, it can, I imagine it would be quite tempting to want to squeeze everything you can possibly imagine into your first attempt, because you wouldn't want to walk away with that with some sort of regret, would you?
Absolutely. And again, one of the issues there comes down to things like not having necessarily the budget and the team and the resources to get external editors in, to get other people to collaborate and help you really hone your skills and kind of, you know, slim down that project. What we see often with, you know, directors who've started from very small, low budgets is that they do everything on their films themselves, or they do it with a couple of friends and maybe one or two other people brought in. But if you don't have that budget, that post-production there, then, you know, editing and making it a really tight, succinct film can be very difficult. And so they are kind of left to their own devices to put in whatever they want. And sometimes the director isn't always right on what that final cut should be.
How true that is. I'm kind of thinking of, because of course last year we saw the Fantastic Four movie, which was one of the most notorious flops in recent memory. Now, that was a second film. The director of that film, his debut film was Chronicle, which of course was a film that he co-wrote the story for. So he had quite a bit of control there as to what was going on the screen and a lot of say creatively in what eventually became that film. Now, just reading through some of the process for how the Fantastic Four movie came together and how all of these major cinematic powers managed to come out with something that was so badly received, you sort of get the feeling here that he didn't really have much control over what was happening there at all. There is that sort of element too, isn't there? That if you are untested, then it doesn't really matter what you're in control of. The finished product will be left to someone else to decide.
Yeah, certainly with big studio films like that and anything that is attached to, you know, these sort of superhero franchises, something that studios invest a lot of money in, what happens there is that, you know, there's so many voices and so much money at stake and so much control that is taken away from the screenwriter and the director in the first instance. I think, you know, Chronicle was an excellent debut feature, showed some very strong filmmaking talent. And what happened with Fantastic Four is that it was a big old mess in the production stages. There were so many people attached and then removed from the project. And eventually it just didn't come together. And I think also rebooting a franchise like that is, you know, it's contentious to start with. So
that's a whole other show. You've actually reminded me of something completely different as well, though. The great director Eric von Stroheim, who was once one of the greatest film directors Hollywood has ever seen. But then he came out with his huge epic Queen Kelly, which most of us only know for seeing a few sequences of inside Sunset Boulevard. Notoriously, of course, Eric von Stroheim submitted about 2 hours of extra footage that he knew was never going to make it into the cinematic cut. And that was the end of his career right there. I think that's probably one of the, well, perhaps as far as old Hollywood goes, it's one of the most famous examples of directors really reaching the peak of their creative authority and having to be told, no, this is, at the end of the day, a commercial enterprise and someone else needs to have a say here.
That right there is, you know, really the crux of the issue that plagues and has always plagued filmmaking, which is that, you know, it is an art form that is commercialized, and those two things don't always go together. Commercial industry and artistic freedom aren't always completely mutually compatible. And so we do see a lot of problems with, you know, sometimes directors who want much more freedom, and often that can be a beautiful thing, but there can also be issues with that too. And sometimes those films then fall flat on their face when they get released, often many years later, to be kind of critically acclaimed or to have some value found in them again. But at the end of the day, money is put up for these films and they are expected to make that back at the box office.
Well, let's move on now to the first film up for discussion today. It's the 1950 debut by Michelangelo Antonioni, Cronaca di un amore, or Story of a Love Affair.
Hai visto? Deve rallentare per forza. Io mi metto sul bordo dell'argine. La macchina passa a 3 metri. Impossibile sbagliare.
Sì, impossibile.
Che aria buona qui. È già campagna.
E quella gente?
Tra 2 ore non c'è più nessuno.
Guido.
Dimmi.
Hai paura?
No, perché?
Guido, se lasciassimo stare non ci pensassimo più.
E poi? Anche tu dicevi che non si può continuare così.
Sì, ma...
Ma?
Poco fa la tua voce era così triste.
This is such a fascinating and lush piece of work. Now, the story revolves around Paola, the attractive wife of a wealthy industrialist. Her husband has asked a detective agency to look into her background, though unbeknownst to him, she's carrying on an affair and may have had some involvement in a rather dark incident in the past. Tara, if some first films, as we were just saying, from some acclaimed directors can seem a little adolescent later in their careers, I would suggest this is not one of them. When I was watching this film, I found it very beautiful and very compelling to look at. How do you think it sits amongst Antonioni's other works?
The thing about Antonioni is that he really has a trajectory that goes all the way from neorealism right into existentialism, and you can trace that very clearly through his work. So his early documentaries were, you know, about neorealism. He was making films that had real content in them. And then this is his move into feature filmmaking, into drama, as it were. What we see in this film, I think, is more of a focus on things like plot, character, than we see in his later works. By the time we get to his very acclaimed trilogy, La Ventura, La Notte, and Le Clisse, what we actually see is that the drama revolves around the characters' existential states, their psychology. Certainly, in a similar way, his visual style has carried through. We still see those landscapes and their relation to the characters in the same way. That's there in his early work. But what falls away throughout his career is some of the focus on those plot points. So the first film for Antonioni is really somewhere between kind of neorealism, film noir, and a kind of existentialism. But he's sort of using film noir, I think, as a gateway to give him the platform to kind of try out some of those techniques. And what we discover is that he's really good at character, and he's really good at finding ways of showing those characters' internal states. And that's often through the dynamic of a love triangle. This is, you know, a trope that comes up again and again in his cinema. And I think he's mesmerized by the kind of sexual attraction that a femme fatale can have, but he strips that away. So by the time we get to those more famous films later in his career, and with Monica Vitti as the sort of lead character in that trilogy, we see a more pared back femme fatale. So she doesn't have the hat and the shoes and, you know, everything quite so slick. It's a 1960s more kind of carefree aesthetic. And this is the modern Italian woman. So he moves into a kind of modernism as well with his work. But certainly you can see the steps are there. It's a beautiful trajectory in his career, certainly a strong debut. And I think what you see with a director like this is that there's going to be something more to come.
As we were saying, it's better to debut with something that becomes a bit of a slow burner and introduces the world to your talents, and perhaps even yourself to your own talents as well. Interesting you pick up on film noir there, because as I was watching this, that was the first thing that came to mind. Not just because I am such a film noir fan, which probably, well, I'm fairly certain is probably evident to many of our listeners by now, but just because it's interesting to look at what is ostensibly a film noir coming out of Italy in 1950, because, of course, film noir became a thing in Hollywood, largely because you had the influence of European filmmaking clashing with the traditional style of filmmaking that was evident in Hollywood at the time. So you had this beautiful cocktail of themes just coming together that previously perhaps wouldn't have seemed to be very compatible at all. How do you think that this may have been received back in 1950 by Italian audiences, or even European audiences more broadly?
Well, I think that Antonioni has always been someone who's stepped slightly to the side of the trend or what's happening. His films don't really adhere to movements in the same way as, you know, we see other directors. So, you know, in France, while we've got the kind of Nouvelle Vague going on, and we've got people who are very much a part of something that's happening with a number of filmmakers and a kind of collective, Antonioni's sort of always standing on his own. So this is a step out of him deciding that this is a form of filmmaking or a genre that he can explore those ideals within. And it makes really a lot of sense. You know, if you think about the tropes of the film noir, this is a really good place to kind of bring plot in to propel your narrative forward in a very classical narrative sense, but also to give you the freedom to explore how characters might relate to one another. And why it's not a strict film noir, I think, is because we do see probably a little bit more in the character development and their psychology than we would in a Hollywood film noir, for example, because those films are a lot pacier. They move much faster. And Antonioni has always been really concerned with pacing. And he takes his time. His films are quite slow, but they also have these really beautiful dance sequences almost in the internal spaces. So while we see these sprawling landscapes and the characters kind of set against these barren landscapes that are quite damning, we also have these interior moments where often the male and female character will kind of dance around the room and the camera will follow them in a very fluid way. And so those filmmaking techniques is what he's trying out here.
I think it's interesting that you, especially as you pick up there about how the camera moves very delicately in some of those sequences, and often when you talk about film noir during the classic era of the 1940s, at least, the term gritty realism often comes up. That's not a term that I would associate with this film's story of a love affair at all. It doesn't feel very gritty, it actually feels very glistening and beautiful, especially with some of the outfits that the actress Lucia Bose is wearing during this film. It's absolutely stunning. I'm terrified to ask the question, but do you think it's possible that we had a bit of a reversal of influences here, and perhaps Antonioni was somewhat influenced by some of Hollywood's filmmakers of the time?
I absolutely do. I think he was really keen to make a break with some of that Italian neorealism. I think that, you know, that has so much standing in Italian filmmaking, and it's so much of what the rest of the world certainly sees. And I think he was influenced by American filmmaking and decided to take from that. But again, what's really interesting about the way in which this develops is that he's kind of taking something from each position and blending it together to make it into something of his own, which is why, even though we can call this film in some senses a film noir, it doesn't fit comfortably within that category. It still sits somewhere outside of it because it is reaching for something else.
You are listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll look back at the first film by Todd Haynes, director of 2015's standout achievement, Carol. And why did Stanley Kubrick disown his feature debut? Stay tuned.
With his experimental approach to capturing landscapes in stunning detail, Peter Bo Repmond is one of the most prolific voices working in cinema today. Starting this weekend, movie subscribers in the US have the opportunity to catch a different Repmond picture every weekend. This Sunday, it's Psychohydrography, a beautifully shot analysis of flowing water from the Sierra Nevada to the Pacific Ocean. That's Peter Bo Repmond this Sunday and next Sunday, and the one after that too, exclusive to MUBI.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with MUBI. Tara Judah is my guest today. Tara, I want to talk about the first time anyone saw a feature by Todd Haynes soon. First, though, let's cast our mind back to a time when the name Stanley Kubrick meant very little to the international community. His debut, it seemed, did little to change that.
There is war in this forest. Not a war that has been fought, or one that will be, but any war. And the enemies who struggle here do not exist unless we call them into being. This forest then, and all that happens now, is outside history. Only the unchanging shapes of fear and doubt and death are from our world. These soldiers that you see keep our language and our time, but have no other country but the mind.
That was a clip there from Stanley Kubrick's directorial debut, Fear and Desire, from 1953. Tara, take us back a little bit to what's happening here in Kubrick's debut.
So Kubrick really didn't want this film re-released at all. He tried very hard to suppress this film. He's embarrassed by it. He's publicly called it boring, a bumbling, you know, mess. He's really vitriolic against this film. And when you first lay eyes on it, I think there's two things that come to mind. One is that you can empathize and see why he thinks that. It's not nearly as slick and polished as any of his other work. We've come to expect so much from this filmmaker. He is so controlled in his style and in everything that goes into the frame and in the way in which he crafts his stories. So you can see that there's a little bit of, there's some poor scripting at times, the dialogue's a little bit clunky, the acting's not superb, it's a little rough around the edges. At the same time, I think we can see a work of an incredible filmmaker coming to fruition. And what we can see through that is because he's experimenting with film style and he's putting together the visual language that he will then go on to use in all of his subsequent films. In the early parts of the film, we are very disoriented. We see a move between mid-shot, close-up, extreme close-up. He kind of breaks the 180 rule very early on in the film. He's very much giving us a kind of violent aesthetic and one that's disorienting. And I think part of that is to do with the fact that this story also is one that's disorienting. We don't know what war this is. We don't actually know what country they're in or who they're fighting. These soldiers have fallen on the wrong side of you know, their barracks and they're kind of trying to get back there. We know that. But we don't know very much else. And all of those things he's withholding, he's kind of giving us a violent aesthetic to make us feel really uncertain and not to know what's actually happening. Even with the voiceover narration, we don't know if people are speaking out loud or if that's in their heads. We don't always know which thoughts are internalized. And I think that those sorts of devices is just his way of kind of playing with film style, trying to work out what is the best way of showing these sort of existential ideas that are going on and this horrible fear and desire that really fuels warfare.
So I think at its core here, what we have is an experimental film from Stanley Kubrick. Perhaps for his own benefit, he might have been better off just making this for himself and then working out, I've got to improve on this, let's move on. But of course, he didn't have that benefit. So his debut is something that he's incredibly unhappy with, but for him to then grow to hate it as much as he has, do you think that plays into the kind of person he is, that he just has to be a perfectionist with everything that he makes? Or do you think perhaps he's a little bit out of touch with why people really do appreciate his work?
I think it's a little of both. I think he certainly is a perfectionist. You know, you hear stories from people who've worked on Stanley Kubrick films who say that it's grueling and it's difficult, and he will meticulously shoot and reshoot and reshoot until it's perfect. So there is certainly that element of, you know, being unhappy with the fact that there's dialogue in this film that seems really plain and obvious, but at the same time, what that dialogue does is it stands in for where he hasn't worked out how to use the camera to explain the interiority of the characters yet. And so I think there's an embarrassment that it feels almost like people can see his mistakes. If you think about, you know, we're all human, and it is embarrassing when people watch you make mistakes. And I guess one of the things about filmmaking is it's immortalized. It's kind of, you know, it's put there forever, and it's something that we can all go back to. At the same time, it is unfair on audiences to try and suppress that work, because it's such a key film in, you know, the trajectory of his filmography. It also is a really good film. I mean, this is a bold debut. It's got problems. It's not 100% perfect. But for a film to be perfect, that's not the only thing that makes a film great. That's not something that doesn't have value. You know, we can still learn so much from his early work. And I think what you see as well is seeds that come out later in films like Paths of Glory and Full Metal Jacket, his obsession with the way that man is so destructive. And I think he's come out and you know, spoken about that, how he feels that, you know, inherently mankind is, you know, a very destructive force, and that we're violent animals. And so this is an earlier, rawer depiction of that. It's always going to be difficult, because if a filmmaker has their intention, and, you know, you want to have some respect for that. I still think that there's a lot of value in this film, though, and, you know, that it's not really something to be embarrassed by.
Well, finally today, let's turn our attention to a science fiction dramatic horror film with homoerotic themes. I speak, of course, Tara, of none other than 1991's Poison.
I did it!
Dr. Graves?
Yes, I'm Dr. Graves, and I've just captured the sex drive.
Oh, that's marvelous. It means the molecular coagulation theory holds true.
Molecular coag... How do you know that? Who are you?
I'm Dr. Olson.
Who?
Dr. Olson. Nancy Olson. From Boston. Dr. Strick recommended me to you regarding...
I didn't expect a woman.
Tara, 2015 will probably be remembered for Star Wars and Jurassic World. For me, it was very much the year of Carol. Todd Haynes has become one of the finest directors working today, and we often look at Far From Heaven, I'm Not There, Safe as examples of his mastery. What are your thoughts then when we revisit some of his earlier films, such as Poison?
The thing about Todd Haynes is that it's easy to forget that he actually came from part of a movement of new queer filmmaking, and that, you know, Poison sat very squarely within that kind of cinema. It was that really propelled him forward. It's not to say that he doesn't continue to make queer films, or that he doesn't continue to have a position in queer cinema, but because some of his films have become slightly more appreciated and mainstream, I think people tend to forget that. So Far From Heaven is a film that we think immediately of Julianne Moore and Douglas Sirk. You know, those are the kind of references that come straight to mind, the appreciation of this brilliant actress and the way in which he's homaging melodrama and early cinema. However, really what he's doing is he's constantly casting a kind of queer eye over different types of filmmaking and these different types of relationships within film. And all of the relationships within his film are a type of queer. Safe is an example that people don't think maybe fits within that sort of overarching narrative because it's about a woman who's constantly kind of regressing and moving away from life and other people. But in a sense, that's a reversion to a position that is against the mainstream. So all of his films have this kind of countercultural aesthetic towards it. Poison is obviously the most bombastic and more out there. And I think, you know, it's interesting to see that he's gone from that position to then a more kind of subdued filmmaking.
It's almost like he started off screaming his message and then realized that, oh, if I say the same thing, or at least say a similar thing, but say it in a more subtle and clever way, more and more people might be interested.
Yeah, definitely. I think also, you know, what we've seen is that he's come to love his characters in a way through his latest films, I think, that maybe wasn't quite there in the early cinema. He really holds his camera over his leading ladies. I think he fell in love with Julianne Moore. It's a completely understandable thing to do. And he can't stop looking at her. And that moves from Safe, it moves through Far From Heaven. We see it with Rooney Mara and Cate Blanchett in Carol. And he's going back to working with Julianne Moore for his next project. So we're going to see more of that fascination with women. I think it's interesting to see a male filmmaker make so many films about women, particularly when his earlier film was, you know, queer filmmaking that was very much adhering to that kind of genre or category.
Yes, and he's, of course, very, in some ways, notorious. Early film which told the story of Karen Carpenter using Barbie dolls. Of course, it sounds ridiculous, but when you watch it, it does, I mean, it comes across as this quite disturbing experience, doesn't it? The fact that it's told in such a crude way with children's toys, but this story is so serious and the way that the film is made sort of seems to take it quite seriously too. And it does play into what you were picking up there, that running theme of all Todd Haynes' films, which seems to be people, mostly women, being punished for being something that is outside of the mainstream.
Yeah, it's this idea as well of, you know, the ideals of beauty and what's expected in society, because that's the other thing that we often see break down in his films and what's underneath these characters. They're all very troubled people, you know, and they all come up against adversity for one reason or another, and whether or not that's to do with kind of, you know, the misplaced desire of non-heteronormative values, you know, in the worlds that he creates, is that we see this breakdown of that perfect aesthetic. His films are so beautiful and the characters are styled so well. You know, they're some of the most beautiful images of women that you'll ever see. But underneath that, there's this idea that, you know, that kind of perfection and beauty can't last. That's not what is intriguing about someone. That's not the thing that's really there. There's something deep and interesting underneath that. And I think, you know, that's something that he has worked with throughout his whole career. It comes from probably a fascination with Barbie dolls and that kind of plasticity of the female character in terms of what value she's given by society, not necessarily by the people who know her.
It's funny. I think we all share a bit of a fascination with Barbie dolls for one reason or another. Tara Judah, thank you very much. And that, of course, brings us to the end of this week's show. Special thanks to my guest today, film critic Tara Judah. The titles we discussed today are playing on MUBI in the US or the UK. That was, of course, Michelangelo Antonioni's debut, Story of a Love Affair, Stanley Kubrick's debut, Fear and Desire, and, of course, Poison from Todd Haynes. Check MUBI.com for details. Listen again and find out more about this show over at monocle.com or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or SoundCloud. And you can always get in touch with me by sending an email to br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show returns next week. Until then, I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.